All right, welcome to class. Hopefully the projector will turn on here at some point. Anyway, that's weird. Come on. All right. So a few little changes. I went through all of your responses to the quiz, the poll this morning around 10. So 36, I think, of you had responded. And if I took the mean number of days you asked for each topic and divide it by the number of days you said we had left in the semester, no single topic got even a day. So instead I used median, and that got a lot closer, but had way too many days. Anyway, so I picked some from mostly from the most requested topics, and I added in something that would make several of them easier, and we'll see how it goes. And then there's a whole lot I didn't get to, and that's just how it is. Oops. So that's the nature of this class. And, you know, it'll be next offered probably in 2 years, so you probably won't get to take it again. Anyway, sorry. But we'll do our best. Also, I wrote up homework 4. It's very similar to something we previewed before. I cleaned it up a little bit and simplified it a little bit. So you have to do one file. It does have to be HTML JavaScript. Okay? And it needs to be something spinning around with something I think looks like light. That's it. Oh, and perspective. Must be perspective, something spinning around, something that looks like light. We didn't talk about how to do all of that when we talked about WebGL, but you've done all of that before, and there are lots of tutorials and so on. I expect most people learn WebGL through looking at other people's example code. Just tell me who you looked at, and everything will be fine, right? Because our goal here is to get your feet wet rather than to make you an expert. And it's fine if you copy stuff as long as you know what you copied and you understand it and you didn't use it exactly the way it was. And then the optional works a little different here. You'll get 50 optional points if you do one of the optionals. You will not get 100 optional points if you do two of them. You'll still get 50. Okay? So if you want 100% credit on this, you do the required, you do an optional. If you have excess optional from others, you just do the required. Largely because this feels a whole lot like teaching you a niche technology that in 10 years will have been replaced by something nobody knows what, and thus less important in my mind than the other topics. Yes?
Is this the last chance to get optional credit this
homework? No. So let's actually talk about the final project as well. So there's two options for the project. We'll come back to this in a little bit. One is you do your own, I'll come to that in a moment. The second one is there's an image manipulation. And if you read through this other one, it's written just like all the others. It has required features worth 50%, and it has optional features worth stuff. So there's optional credit for this assignment too. And if you pick your own, what will happen? In 2 weeks, I will ask for proposals about what you're doing with sets of tasks, and we will break it into required and optional. You will propose what you think they are. I will tell you you've bit off twice what you can chew. I will give it back to you. That will be your task. Okay? I may actually ask for those next week so that we can handle them the week after. So if you're thinking of doing something on your own or in a small group or want to define a new homework 5 for the whole class, all of these are okay, right? But probably next week I need to think more about the process here, but I will ask for you to submit some sort of outline of what you hope to do. And I will try to scope it a little bit better for you, having done most of this before and realizing how hard it all is. And that can be your project instead of the optional, option 2 version of the project. Questions? Yeah?
Is option 2 really a project or just another homework?
They're both just another project, homework.
I just wondered if it was supposed to feel longer.
No, both will be the same length as a regular assignment. The first time I taught this course, I made the project take the place of 2 homeworks. So I didn't have homework 4, I made homework 4 and homework 5 both this thing and made it really big. And that turned out to be an unfortunate decision for people that are bad at time management. And I decided time management matters, but I don't feel like I can teach it to you, so you know, we'll be a little bit nicer. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could clarify again the grading for the optional pools and the.
Yeah, sure. Let's do this. So there are required and optional. Okay, and there are five assignments. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There is also the warm-up, it's not worth anything. Okay, and if you got it wrong, you didn't get points off, but you also didn't do anything else, so right, you all got it right. All right, so each of these have between, no, that should be a Q. Each of these have between 0 and 50 that you can get, and so that forms one pool. So I add all those up together, and I divide by 250, and that's your required score. And that's half of your assignment score in the course. And then I take all of these, which in general could be up to about 200. I sum all of those up, and I also divide them by 250. And then I drop the excess. Okay, so if it ends up more than one, I drop it. I sometimes feel vaguely inspired to encourage you to do more work, and will, instead of dropping it, like multiply it by 0.01 and then add it in anyway. But I try not to do much more than that, because if extra credit isn't extra, then why did we call it that? Right, so if I were just keep all your excess points here at full point, there'd be no difference between required and optional, and you could ignore the stuff that's most important and anyway. So basically, if you have 250 points here, great, and then there's this pool of points. If you think, oh no, I got a 20 on one of these, my grade is doomed, fix it and give it back to me, right? It's fine. I want you to learn the material. Deadlines are mostly for your sanity. Does this clarify? Other questions? Yes?
Is there going to be any kind of like dropping or scaling for quizzes or anything?
Yeah, so I typically drop 10% of the quizzes, which in this class will probably be one. I might drop two because some of them have been a little bit odd. And I typically weigh them all equally, even though some of them have many more points. Because, I don't know, I just typically do. It's easier math, I guess. Other questions? Yeah?
We do the final, right?
We do, which will be made out of slightly reworded questions that people got wrong in quizzes. So I'm not going to come up with brand new things to ask. Right, it will just be that stuff. That does actually mean, though, as we look at the schedule, okay. So you'll notice our class, this is actually unusual. Usually classes end not on a Friday, but on a Tuesday. But I am going to make a quiz for this week because I want to be able to test all of the weeks of class, not all but one. So there will be a quiz released at the end of this class that I am theoretically required to make due the last day of classes, but I'm allowed to accept it late with no penalty, right? So it will be due at the end of day Friday, but really due at the same time as always, right? And then that will be one of the quizzes that will potentially be part of the final exam. Other questions? Yes?
Will the final exam be like taken here on paper?
Yep, you will come here and I will have printed out copies of questions and you will take it. I have never had somebody spend more than half of the allotted time on the final. Yes?
Is it open notes?
No. Oh, yes?
So we should study the quizzes.
Yep. You should study in particular the parts of the quizzes you didn't do well on the first time, but also the parts you did and forgot. Right. Yeah?
So will there be like calculators required or allowed or whatever?
We've only had maybe one question that needed that so far. I think what I will do is if I think you need to do a calculation, I'll make sure it comes out clean. Because that's easier than keeping track of the fact that calculators are just pocket computers with bad interfaces and can do anything. Yes?
Is there a way for the quizzes to like retake it for like practice purposes? It just like shows the answer, right?
In principle, yeah. I don't currently have that set up. Pop me an email and I will find a way of giving out blank copies of the quizzes. I don't think I can readily make it so you can retake and get regraded by the system, but I can certainly make copies, a copy of the quiz without the answers available to take it on your own and then compare. Other questions? Okay. So, let's talk about what we're doing for the next little while. Today we're going to do more animation. We'll start with inverse kinematics and probably spend about half of our time on that and then talk about a handful of other topics, lattices and so on. And then there was the only one that the majority of people said they wanted at least 2 days on fluids. So we'll have 2 days of fluids, and then there is also several about physics-based animation, physics-based rendering and object collapse, destruction and so on. I don't know, we'll see if these can be merged or not. I haven't thought a whole lot about these, how well do these two yet. But to help all of those go well, we'll actually start by spending a whole class on volume representation, which will make a lot of these things easier. Which we didn't talk about, but it's necessary for all of this. After that, we'll then get into real-time eye candy. Like all the things, I mean, you've learned real-time graphics already, but all the things that make people say, ooh, right? I may change my mind about this. Lots of people ask for it. I am certainly not an expert at what companies do, having never worked for a company. But I hear about and so on, so we'll try to talk about the whole process of going from idea to money. Then we had a lot of things that didn't have a whole lot of votes, so I took a few of those. Trees and terrains, which are sort of, we can pretend they're related. And so we'll try doing those on a day. We'll probably do like skin and leaves and related kind of rendering things, and that's the plan. And a lot of topics didn't make it, sorry. We just didn't have anywhere near enough time for the number of topics we had. So that's our plan. And therefore today, the plan is to talk some more about animation. Before we dive in, is there anything you've been looking at recently? You want to describe why it looks that way? Yeah?
What about things that get darker when they're wet?
I think we actually talked about this one already, didn't we?
In passing.
Ah. Yeah, things that get darker when they're wet. Let's talk about, so basically they get darker because they get shinier. Okay, there are other reasons that can happen, but this is the common one that makes almost everything that's wet get darker. Okay, so if I think about any given, the number of photons that leave the object cannot exceed the number of photons that enter the object. Okay, and so if a lot of them are being bounced shiny, then there are less left to bounce diffuse. When we add a thin layer of water over an object, because water has a smooth electromagnetic potential in the visible light spectrum, it is shiny or transparent, but this will create a shine. The light that bounces off in a shiny way is no longer available to bounce in every other direction. Some objects also interact with water in other ways that reduce their brightness. So some things get darker in other ways as well. But that has to do with all of it has to do with how it changes the interface that the light has to deal with. Another reason you can see this, depending on how light the water bonds with it, so hydrophilic materials, which will have it sort of go all around, as opposed to hydrophobic, which will have it go in between, or hydroneutral, which won't, anyway. If it goes all around, this can also cause a phenomenon where light will come down and some of the light, as it bounces off of the object, will hit the surface of the water at an angle that will bounce it back down again. This will have multiple goes at getting absorbed. So even if there isn't a chemical change in the optical properties here, the diffuse light has a chance of going at such an angle if there's a film of water as opposed to some other way the water distributes of being bounced around again and getting absorbed. But the real answer would have to depend on the particular thing you're looking at for the ones that get really dark, right? And sometimes you do more than get dark. There are kinds of rock, for example, that just sort of like a dull gray, and then they get red, wet, and suddenly they have red and green stripes on them. And like, where did those come from? I don't know. I've never studied rocks. But there are a few that are common, which is why almost everything gets a little darker when it gets wet. Yes?
Just for another one,
yeah.
Why would you take a picture of a computer screen and all these like dark patterns show up?
Yeah, why do computer screen pictures not work? This actually it doesn't have to be the case. And if you have the right screen and the right camera, you'll get a perfectly fine picture. But most of us don't, right? So if we think about a screen, most of our computer screens have something like a 60 frame per second refresh rate. what happens between those steps? Old screens would have a scanning raster, like the cathode would scan across the screen, and so you have very bright pixels and very not bright pixels, and a picture of those would take a snapshot of that, and you would clearly see this scan line progressing that was too fast for most people's eyes to notice. Things like LCDs don't have that, but they do have a process of periodic update. Okay? And so depending on exactly the technology being used, there is a period of time when they are deciding to change. They're usually on, but sometimes changing. And because sending information to all million plus pixels on your screen at once is a bandwidth problem, it tends to get sent unevenly across your screen. And so at any given moment in time, most common screens will have, at a minimum, some pixels having one frame and some pixels having the previous. And often that transition involves some amount of going dark. And so if you take a picture, you can see that. This is one of the phenomena that can come. Another phenomena that can come is that under the hood, our screen is not uniformly bright, right? And so we actually saw some pictures of this earlier. But let's look at way back when we were talking about colors. Oh, nope. That's not what I want. Yeah, so when we look close up, our computer screen has different regions of different colors. They're small enough they blur together in our eyes. Okay? So does your camera. Your camera is essentially, a digital camera in particular, is just this backwards. Instead of emitting, it absorbs light. If the green of your camera doesn't line up with the green of the screen, then you won't see green. And typically, they won't have exactly the same spacing, so you'll end up with some sort of aliasing artifact as two color grids are superimposed at different angles with different spacing. Again, this can be changed. You can make a camera that instead of taking red, green, blue next to each other, takes an entire red exposure, entire green exposure, entire blue exposure back to back. Right? There are ways of making cameras that don't have this phenomena. There are ways of making screens have more integrated dots and so on. But all of these can cause the phenomena that on the camera looks smooth in a smooth world, it makes a not smooth screen look smooth, both in time and space, and they can interact with each other poorly. Other questions? All right. Let's talk about animation. So last time we talked about the big ideas of animation. Yes?
I have a question about animation.
Yeah.
You were saying, basically the idea is that you draw lots of images together.
Yep.
But if you were ray tracing or something, would you not want to determine what is changing between frames and what isn't, and only draw on things that are changing? Is that a technique that's used, I guess?
So, in real-time rendering, the short answer is almost always everything's changing. The camera's moving in real-time stuff most of the time. And that means we need to redraw everything. And when we have a static camera, it's usually in a movie, and the movies usually care enough to do some sort of global illumination. So there is some benefit we can get sometimes in our important sampling of our global illumination of assuming that lights will be similarly located to where they were last time. And so we can speed things up with a little bit of shared information between frames. It's been a few years since I looked into this, but the last time I did, the decision was it was more work to get that speed up than you could just buy a few more computers and do more parallelism and get that speed instead, right? And so it was not a common process 5-6 years ago, the last time I looked in, to actually do this. And the theoretic speed ups were not as large as we might hope. Other questions about animation, things we've already talked about before I dive into what I had planned to say today? Yeah.
What is global illumination that you just
mentioned? Oh, global illumination is when things that aren't light sources illuminate things. We talked about this with ray tracing, right? When we remember had the picture of the sphere and we said the shadow isn't black, why not? That's global illumination. The whole globe is illuminating. Other questions? All right. So we talked last time about matrices can do joints, and I did a bad job about that. Matrices can be bones. I did a bad job about that, and you helped me fix it, hopefully. We're going to pick up on that idea and talk a little bit about tools we give animators with skeletons and bones. And the first one we're going to talk about is inverse kinematics. IK. Kinematics should just be like things moving in Latin, but other fields are just as bad at using Latin as computing is at using English, so that isn't what it means, right? So kinematics in the context of robotics and computer animation and some other fields as well refers to the idea that you have joints and hinges and moving one thing moves something else. So before we talk about inverse kinematics, let's talk about forward kinematics, which is what is being inverted. Forward kinematics is the idea that if I have some set of joints, okay, that any turn I make around this joint impacts all of these as well. And so I have this forward process. Now, it's forward in the sense, I mean, it's just a relationship. It's a tree or a chain inside the implementation. But from the artist's perspective, forward kinematics is I turn each joint individually, and they all combine to move the foot into place. Okay? And so if I want to move the foot down, I need to turn both the hip and the knee and the ankle to make the foot just move down. And I have to do them one at a time. And typically, if you're doing this, it's easiest to start at the highest joint, because otherwise what you did on the other ones gets messed up. And so we tend to move forward from the center of mass out to the extremity. But usually it's the extremities that we care about. When we think about, I don't know, we want to make our character kick something, we don't think about, now it's really important we have the knee in the right place. That is not the thought we have, right? We're thinking about the foot. And so often what we want to do is to do it invert instead, okay? So the inverse kinematics will say, I want to specify, here is the hip, and here is the foot. And the torso is facing this direction, and I want the foot facing that direction. Make it so. Okay? Figure out what had to happen to the joints to make this be the case. And so we're just going to solve for the position of the knee. Okay? Often, real animation systems will primarily use inverse kinematics, and then they'll also have a little bit of ability for artists to come in afterwards and tweak the results. Although in things like video games, we don't bother having an artist because we're doing it in real time. Okay? And so the question is, how do we make this work? This is the task of inverse kinematics. And I realize I keep saying inverse kinematics instead of inverse kinematics, and I don't know why I haven't done that before. My tongue is weird today. Anyway, kinematics. So let's start with the one case that we can just analytically solve. There are a handful of others. And then we'll talk about why we actually always approximate it in the real world. Questions about what it is before we talk about how to do some of the math? Okay. Yes?
So is it like you have like the end extremity and you work your way back up like towards like the root of the... like?
Yeah, typically we actually anchor both ends. And we just find where do I put all the bones in between to make those two there. Other questions? All right. Let's start with one case that we can just solve. And we will take, let's suppose I have two bones of equal length, and that's all I have. Okay? So I have two bones of equal length. I can solve for the knee position precisely, modulo 1 degree of freedom. Okay? How do I do this? If I know that here I have my hip and here I have my ankle, and I want to know where my knee is, and I know that both of these joints are length L, okay? By nature of triangles, we can solve this problem. We can say we know that it's going to be exactly halfway down the line between the hip and the ankle, and it's going to be some amount of distance perpendicular to that. And how far perpendicular to that is it going to be? Well, we just use the hypotenuse formula. Okay? So given that h and a are inputs, we can find this vector, we can find a perpendicular vector, we can figure out how far to go, we can say, there's the knee. Boom! And we solve the problem. The problem here, of course, is that this is 3D, and so the solutions to that is all perpendicular vectors. This actually lets us spin the knee all the way around, right? As knees sort of can do, they can't go all the way around, right? And so we have a degree of freedom left over. What do you do with the degree of freedom? You could just say, oh, let's try to make the knee as close to where the knee used to be as we can, and within this constraint. And this will work okay. It turns out for knees, we can do one better. That's not necessarily correct. One model of the ideal level of fitness of legs and feet suggests that the knee, and if you, so there is a model that says if you take the hip, let's try drawing out little bones here. So if I have the hip, and I have the knee, and I have the ankle, and I have the foot. And so there is a model that says that the plane that is defined by the ankle, the toe, and the hip will also include the knee, that these will all be coplanar points. Okay? So this is, so what does this mean? This means, let's see. All right, this means that I would expect the plane that contains my hip, my ankle, and my toe to also include my knee. I would not expect my toe to be off to one side or the other of my knee. Okay? So I expect if my toe moves, my knee moves. This is not always true. You are capable of doing other things. But many people typically have a rest pose like this, and artists typically tell us what direction the foot is facing, so we can use this as a tiebreaker to decide where to put the knee. Okay? And so riggers, people responsible for creating the set of constraints on bones, will often put in a knee stays above foot rule into their system. But there is a degree of freedom here. Okay? And this extra degree of freedom is typical of inverse kinematics. Inverse kinematics, why do we keep saying metics? I don't know. Anyway, inverse kinematics almost always has extra degrees of freedom. The artist is under constraining the scenario. And so it's on the computer to decide what is the right thing to do. This rule does not work for elbows. It is not the case that the wrist, fingers, and shoulder always have the plane of the elbow. If I tell you to flip over your hands, you don't flip over your elbow, right? We use our wrists a lot more than our ankles. And so this doesn't work there, and so you can make other rules, right? Most people are lazy, and they basically keep their elbows down, right? But some people are excited, and they poke them out all the time, so you don't want to sit next to them in a restaurant, right? And so there's heuristics we can use. We can say it's close to where it used to be. We can try to put some sort of people are lazy rules, but we have a degree of freedom. Yes?
Who specifies the rules, the artist or the programmer?
Typically, the artist doesn't, many artists don't know how to specify the rules. They know when it looks wrong and you'd say it should be over here. And then a programmer or a rigger sits them while watching what they're saying and then says, oh, here's the principle, and then tries to codify it. Often, the software will provide a means for an artist, the rigger, to supply the constraints. So I have a special bone constraint language that can be used, usually through a GUI interface of some kind, for describing rules on how things behave, to try to remove this extra degree of freedom that we generally don't want to get wrong. So here's our first little bit of inverse kinematics. Kinematics. Wow, I'm stuck on this wrong pronunciation. I don't know what happened to my mouth today. Anyway. Thoughts, comments, questions so far before we get to how it gets really hard. Okay, it gets really hard. Because this kind of joint is not the most common kind. Okay, let's consider one that seems similar but so isn't. let's consider, I don't know, how about we have some sort of quadruped that's standing here, right? Now quadrupeds, if we think about the basic quadrupedal skeleton, typically what the artist wants to give is, and this can vary a bit depending on how concerned the artist is with things, but sort of the overall direction and position of the torso, and then the hoof. Okay? But then we also have, there is this technically a toe joint above the hoof. There is an ankle joint, a knee joint, a hip joint, and then the spine can bend. Right? We have a lot of joints. And what do we do with all of those joints? Now again, we can make heuristic rules. It turns out that, for example, if you've ever manually tried to move your dog's leg, you will realize that dogs have a rule that says the ankle and the knee will be similarly bent. Cats don't. I don't know if you've ever played around with pets, right? Anyway, okay. At least it isn't nearly as strong as it is, right? So you can make some rules, try to remove some degrees of freedom. But this, you know, these rules change by creature, and if we're saying, oh, now we have the strange creature from planet Y that we have to populate, what rules are we supposed to use? Okay? And so in general, we might have many joints. Some of them might be constrained, some of them not constrained, some of them partially constrained. We have some heuristics, but we still have several extra degrees of freedom. And we don't, in general, have something like, well, we've noticed that knees stay in line with the foot, or the elbows tend to hang down, or so on. We tend to have to come up with what we want to do. So, we have the general problem of inverse kinematics. I said it right, hooray. All right. General problem of inverse kinematics. There are several families of solutions. The traditional one is based on the Jacobian. Who remembers what a Jacobian is, or even what discipline it comes from? Yes? Okay, we use it in calculus and geometry, and what is it?
It is the determinant of the partial of the function with respect to all its variables.
The derivative, not the determinant. Okay. So the determinant is just a single number.
Well, the determinant of, like, the
No, we want the Jacobian matrix. Sorry, I should say. We want the Jacobian matrix, not the, yes. Okay. So the Jacobian matrix is all partial derivatives. So this requires multiple variables in and multiple variables out. What are the variables? So in general here, our independent variables will be our rotations, okay? And our dependent variables is the end position, okay? So typically fix one end, the hip end effectively, will then say, I want to know how changing rotations changes the position. I will find this derivative matrix. Derivatives have the nice characteristic that they are linear approximations of smooth functions. Okay? And so if I have this linear approximation, I have here something that says, okay, here is my original scenario, and now I want to know what is the derivative of the position of that end point based on each of the angles, independently of the others. So I say, if you turn this 1 degree, what does this change in x and y? If you turn this 1 degree, what does this change in x and y? If you turn this 1 degree, what does that change in x and y? So I have 3 independent variables, 2 dependent variables, and I end up with a 3x2 matrix, or 2x3. Anyway, I end up with a matrix, right? Where, so I'm going to have, if I were to consider this angles theta, phi and rho, and this is x, y, right? My matrix would be the, I'm not great at drawing partial derivative signs, that's the best I can do. The partial with respect to theta of x, and the partial with respect to phi of x, and the partial with respect to rho of x, and the partial with respect to theta of y, and so on. I realize I wrote two-thirds of them before I stopped. I should have stopped earlier. Anyway, okay, we end up with this matrix. What can we do with this matrix? Well, we can then make a linear approximation of inverse kinematics. We could say, let's pretend that we were just trying to find it. Let's pretend this is a linear function, and if it was a linear function, I did this backwards, didn't I? Don't worry, I can fix it. It'll just make your notes ugly. Theta, y, x. There we are. Magic of erasers. Right, because we want the independent variables in the y. That should be phi. That should be rho. I'm horrible at this. All right. So we could say, given this equation, we could say an approximation, a linear approximation of motion, is that this times our change in theta, our change in phi, our change in rho, is going to give us approximately, this is going to be approximately equal to the change in x and the change in y that we want. Okay? And then we can solve this linear system. Now, this linear system is not invertible, because this isn't even a square matrix. But there's these beautiful things called pseudo-inverses that don't care. Okay? And so we can take the pseudo-inverse of this matrix and apply it on both sides of this and end up finding out what these need to be to make this happen. But that assumes the world's linear, so it's wrong. It gets us closer to where we want to be, but the wrong place, and so we just do it again. We do it over and over again until we're really close, and then we declare ourselves a win. After a few iterations, this starts to converge quadratically, so the number of bits of error tends to, the first couple of steps, if we have big angles, might go, we may only get another digit at a time, but then the number of digits will start doubling every time. And so 3, 4, 5 iterations of this, and we'll end up finding exactly how to move our angles. And because of properties of the pseudo-inverse, we'll do it in a way that that sort of spreads the motion across the different joints. Question?
So how do we know which grade is a positive angle?
We just decide.
And keep it constant for that?
Yeah, we keep it constant for that joint. Yeah, we just pick.
Does it have to be the same for all the joints?
It could, it doesn't have to be. I mean, if we pick a different positivity, then one of these columns will switch signs, but then we'll also find a different sign here, and it will all boil out to the same thing. Okay? So this is one of the first ways we thought about doing IK, inverse kinematics. And it is minimal in a mathematical sense, has a minimal variation because of how pseudo-inverses work. It turns out not to work as well as some others we could hope for. Because beings are not mathematical. It doesn't deal very well with constraints. It doesn't deal very well if you can't reach your target. If the artist says, I want the foot to be beyond where the foot can be, this will tend to cause weird, like, popping and glitching effects. And so people have spent some time studying this and understanding it and figuring out how to do it better, but meh. It turns out not to be what we, this was used for a while, it's no longer the most common, but it's the idea. And I bring this up in part because we're going to see a lot of this idea. Something I doubt you ever learned in your math classes is that another name for linear algebra is the math that computers can do. Okay? And so very often, when we have the real world, which is not linear, we will create a linear approximation of it. We will use it. It will be wrong. We'll use it again. It will be less wrong. We'll keep going until it's good enough. That will be a theme for the next several weeks. We're going to see it over and over again. Okay? And here is one example of that. It is not the case that a tiny movement on theta will have the same behavior on x that a big movement in theta will. So let's pretend they're tiny movements. That's what derivatives does, an infinitesimal movement. How would that change things? We'll pretend it would do that forever. We're wrong. It's okay. The world's basically smooth. We do it several times. We'll converge, hopefully. So this is the Jacobian matrix approach to inverse kinematics. Yes?
Once we've plugged in, like,
So I'll solve for new theta phi in rho that should get me towards my goal, whatever my goal happens to be. And when I add those to these, I won't end up there. Because I have added assuming everything was linear, but instead it's curved. So it will say, okay, my new position should be over here. And like, I'm still off, but I am closer. So then I just re-solve for the Jacobian of this new orientation, redo the pseudo-inverse, readjust the angles, and I'll get closer still, and I will converge. Yes?
Do you redo it using the new x and y?
The new x, the new y, I recompute the Jacobian, I redo the pseudo-inverse, I find new adjustments to my new positions. I keep doing this several times until I got really close to my goal. The first few of these will tend to be quite off. But as the angle differences get smaller, because of the behavior of angles, they're linear for small angles, and they get less linear the farther they go. That's the nature of smooth things. So once I'm pretty close, a single step will, in general, double the bits of precision of my approximation. So if I was off in the second bit of precision before, I'll be off in the fourth bit, and then the eighth bit, and then the 16th bit, and that's as much as I can represent numbers, I can stop. And so it will converge quite quickly after the first few steps if there is a solution. If there isn't a solution, all bets are off. Often what we'll do is we get closer to something having a zero in here somewhere, and then it'll just go clue. Anyway, it blows up in unpleasant ways. Yes?
Can you just make your change in angle really small so that you're only making a linear approximation like between two very small angles?
Well, that's up to the artist. Right, but the artist is the one that's giving me keyframes. It says the foot was over here, I want it to be over there in 10 frames. And so we could say, okay, I will interpolate your target position between those and make sure they're all small, and that will make this a lot more efficient. This is part of the reason why it worked reasonably well in the real world. We can also tell in advance if a target is unattainable. Well, there's actually several ways to do that. Often we can just say it's too far away, you can't get there. Sometimes we can say if it doesn't converge after 10 iterations, it's unattainable, make it closer, find something we can attain, right? There's various cheats we could do there to make this work. And so it actually works okay. It's inefficient compared to some of the ones that have come around later. And we'll talk about one of those here in a moment. But it works. Other questions? Okay. I always forget the weird acronym for this. I should have written it down. There's one. Oh well. I'll just describe it and hopefully the acronym will come to me as I do. All right. About 10, 12 years ago, there was an alternate way of inverse kinematics. There's been several others along the way that we're skipping over. But there's one discovered that worked really well in the sense it's efficient, fast, doesn't have weird singularity poppings when your things are out of reach, and tends to behave in ways that artists at least can intuit. And so here is this model. So I'm just going to describe the algorithm. I'm really upset that I can't remember the name of it. Hopefully it'll come. I have an initial position, and I have a target. Okay? This works. It has no Jacobians, it has no trig, it just has linear math all the way along the way. Well, a few square roots. I guess it has a lot of square roots, okay? So here is the step. We're going to do a forward and a backward pass of the following. We're going to say, all right, let's take our target point, we're going to assume we can reach it. We're going to take a line back to the next joint. We're going to figure out how far we were able to go there. Okay? So we just make sure that whatever this length was, length 1, we use length 1 there as well. Then we repeat with this target and that joint. So we assume that that one can reach there. We make sure that this goes back as far as it can go. So if this was L2, this is L2. And then we do it for the next one. Okay. And so we make sure that that can fit. That was L3, this is L3. I should have changed colors again. I will for the next one. Okay. And then we do it for the last one. And we have L4. Okay. So each of these just includes a subtraction, a finding a length, and offsetting by a certain amount. Basically, you have 1 divide by square root per bone segment. When we completely reached this point. However, we left this point. We're no longer there. Okay? We don't want to have left that point, so then we go backwards. Okay? So then we say, all right, we've done that once. Now we're going to come back the other time, and we're just going to do the same thing from the other direction. So I'm going to force this back to there, draw its line there, move it here, draw this line there, move it there, draw this line there, move it there, draw this line there, move it there. Okay? And now we have found a new set of bone positions that are in some pseudo-intuitive way similar to the originals that have not moved the anchor, they moved the target closer. And I can do it again and get the target closer and do it again, get the target closer. I will converge at least quadratically. If it's out of reach, I'll just straighten out and stop, which is approximately what we want to do if it's out of reach. And it turns out that with relatively minor modifications, I can take at each of these steps and post hoc enforce any extra constraints I have about how angled they can be. And the process just naturally fits in. I don't have to change the math in any way. I just have to say, since I'm going one bone at a time, if a bone doesn't work with a constraint, I just force it to work with the constraint and then continue. Okay? And so this approach works quite well. I'm still not remembering its name. Yeah?
Fabric?
That's right, fabric, thank you. Forward and backward inverse kinematics. How did I forget that? Yes, fabric, thank you. So this has a property artists sort of understand that basically just makes the joints feel sort of lazy and stiff. It's not always something the artist wants, but if you have a fabric system and you start trying to move joints around large distances, you'll tend to notice there'll be more bending close to the target than farther away, but it'll be fairly well distributed. And so you'll get this sort of, the earlier joints seem a little bit stiffer kind of behavior, which the artist can sort of understand. And when the artist can understand what it's going to do, then the artist can figure out weird things to do where they like drag the position in some sort of weird arc to get the position of bones they wanted. Okay? So it has nice behaviors. It works quite well. Yes?
Are we doing this for keyframes or frames?
We're doing this to help the artist, so typically at keyframes. But that actually depends on if the artist has asked us to say I'm positioning a joint and then a joint, or if the artist said I'm telling you the hand needs to follow this path. So if the hand needs to follow this path, I'm doing it from frame to frame. If I'm instead saying the hand was here, it will be over there, find the way in between, then I'll do it for keyframes.
So something you want to change your account is how the motion looks in the intermediate steps as we're like, well, for the previous one with the matrix, as you like as you repeatedly apply the matrix and you do it, is there like a guarantee that it's not going to look really weird?
Oh, you do not show them the intermediate steps of the matrix. You do not show them the intermediate steps of trying to get close here. Both of these are iterative. You apply them several times, but on each frame or on each keyframe.
But if you're doing it for keyframes, then how would you generate the intermediate?
So once I have this, I then have an angle for each joint at each keyframe, and then I interpolate those angles, probably in quaternion space, because the interpolations there work a little better. So if I interpolate the angles between frames, then I'll get a swingy kind of motion. I'll tend to have arcs in my motion, which often looks nice unless people are concentrating on something else. Did I see a hand? No? Okay. Other questions? All right, inverse kinematics. Combined with bones, this gives us a lot of how we give tools for animators to do the animation. But not everything. There are other things they need to do. This is not a great way, for example, of animating a grimace or other facial expressions, because bones aren't face things. This isn't a great way of animating, I don't know, amorphous blobs that bounce around and sing songs about being vegetables, right? there are lots of things this doesn't animate well. And so there are a handful of other techniques that are used. So let's talk about some of those other techniques. We're moving away from bones. Before I do that, any other questions about bones, kinematics? All right. Let's talk about how you go from a smiley face to a frowny face. Hey? If the artist says, this is a smile, this is a frown, and I want to be halfway in between, what do we do? Okay, and the answer is actually, this is one of the easier ones that exists. We linearly interpolate the relative positions of the vertices of the face. Okay, so under the hood, right, what are they really saying? There is some sort of triangulation of the upper lip here. I don't know what it looks like, but we'll just pretend that it's a really strange triangulation, okay? So we have some sort of lattice that the artist has created of different triangles making up the face. And that means we have vertices, okay? And we have an underlying structure. We have the head bone, which is not the skull because it's a bone, it's a matrix. Anyway, right? So we have the head bone that the base of the face is off of. We have a rest position of the face, and in an expression is modeled as we would have sort of our rest expression, whatever the artist did is the original model. And then for everyone, and then that would mean that each of these vertices would have a position in the rest, a position here, and we would store how did the artist move this vertex compared to its rest position. And that same vertex over here may have moved differently. And so if we want to mix expressions, we just have a set of offsets relative to the head bone, so in the local coordinate system of the head bone, of every vertex on the model. And we basically just give them a slider. We can say, I want 30% of the smile offsets and 20% of the raised left eyebrow offsets. Okay? And they can mix and match the different expressions. As an extra, we often will allow them to specify what part of the face was part of this. Okay? So in general, my raised left eyebrow will typically not have any control over the mouth. And so I will say, the raised left eyebrow was only about this part of the face, or maybe the whole brow, because I thought the whole thing would wrinkle, but not about the mouth. And the smile, maybe I say, you know, it deals with cheeks, but it doesn't deal with the eyebrows. And so you can mix and match these and say how much influence each one has over different parts of the face, so you can add them over different parts. And then we let the artist make several of these, so if they give us more than two, if we give a small smile and a big smile, then we can do some sort of parabola instead of a line to interpolate between those points to give a little bit smoother motion. If they just give us two, a line will work fine. And then we just give a whole bunch of expression sliders. And this is how we do things like expressions. This begs the question, how did we let the artist move every single pixel on the face? And that is a topic that I don't think we want to get into. It's just, in general, graphics tools have ways of moving lots of vertices at once, and we will just sort of leave it at that for the moment. Yes?
So with facial graphics and whatnot, like to make like some animated character, like Thanos or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that literally just like a bunch of preset mixes of facial expressions?
Mostly. In the past few years, we've gotten pretty good about doing it without a 3D model at all, by basing it all off of still frames, interpolating and matching expressions from other video. So in recent movies, you probably still have mostly this, but they probably also have somewhere an actor who had all these little dots painted on their face, and then we're told to do different things. And then talk, right? So they use that to key how the expressions work, and then they had them actually say the lines, and they filmed them saying the dialogue. And then they use how those points moved on their face, compared to how they moved in the reference frames, compared to their 3D model, to move all of these places through a motion capture system instead. And then they probably, I don't know the details of any particular movie, but they probably also had some level of, after that was done, then an animator came in and said, you know what, this guy should be able to grimace more than a human, and so they exaggerate things and have the sliders and so on top of that. And then when all of that's done, you finally render the frame, you can then put it through the how do I retarget animations, and so you can actually, in the past few years, we've gotten pretty good at using various convolutional neural networks to figure out how to change the colors of pixels to match expressions across two different pictures. And so they may do some of that as a post-processing step, but usually that's only done when they change the dialogue and don't want to reset the scene. Reshoot the scene. So this is actually fairly commonly done in movies today, where they'll shoot the scene, they'll realize this wasn't the right word, re-record it in the sound studio, and we'll just remorph the mouth after the fact. But that's only just started coming out as an effective tool. Other questions about face animation? Okay, we should mention here, since it should be mentioned somewhere, the idea of the uncanny valley.
Yes.
Creepy robots. All right. The uncanny valley is the term used for, here's
a video.
Sorry?
Videos are usually better.
Videos work better, but they don't get across the idea.
Okay.
Or not quite as clearly, I don't think. So let's look first here. This is trying to be a graph. This is the traditional understanding of the uncanny valley. As you start fully cartoon, the idea is we're going to map how much does it actually look like a human, and how much do people think it feels like a human, okay? And so the idea is, as you get more and more like a human, it looks more and more like a human to people, until at some point it starts looking really, really bad. Okay, and the more things you have, the more animation and so on is included, the more this drops down. Okay? And this is the concept of the uncanny valley. And it's named after this idea that there's an uncanny resemblance to something real. It's the creepy doll effect, right? This is the idea of the uncanny valley. It tends to be much more pronounced in movies. And because of this, you tend to see a lot of, like, a CG movie almost never tries to look like the real world, because it's hard to do that. So intentionally, sometimes they'll actually go back after they made it and then intentionally add weird things. An excellent example of this that I happened to notice when I saw a roommate watching something once. If we go for Star Wars, The Clone Wars, let's see. Let's find a face here. All right, sure, let's do Yoda. We have no reason to have any canny characteristic for Yoda, right? Yoda doesn't exist. We've only ever seen models of Yoda. And yet, notice what they did here. They added random creases to the eyebrows. Okay? The people that made this film made high-ish quality models and then just added random little creases and things to make it look less real. Okay? I don't know all of the decisions the artist went through in making this, but part of it was to make sure you remembered we aren't trying to show you what the actor that played Mace Windu really looked like, because that could be vaguely insulting or uncanny. We're saying this is a cartoon that's supposed to look somewhat like. Is we make a pretty good model, and then we add these random ridges and weird smooth pots and bulges here and make the eyebrows four times too large and whatever it is to make it look a little less like, so you won't think about it as being a bad resemblance of an actor, but rather an interesting cartoon. Okay? And so there's all kinds of ways of trying to push yourself away from that uncanny valley. Sometimes you will see films that try to go to the other side. And trying to actually get good enough that it feels okay. And some of them do an okay job, but typically that's a lot harder than staying on the cartoon side. And so you'll tend to see a lot of this overtly cartoonish facial features in particular, because humans are really good at noticing facial features. So, the uncanny valley exists. It's also worth thinking about. It's something the artist thinks about much more than the computer scientist, right? We make the tools to render stuff, they pick how many of them to use to make it look okay. All right. Anything else about faces? All right. What if you want to make something, I don't know, we want to have our character is a sphere. But sometimes our sphere jumps. So it's going to squash down and then boing, right? How do we do this? And we probably want our eyes to say, maybe we want our eyes to squish and stretch, or maybe we want our eyes to say flat, right? We could do different ways. We want this to zoop, right? However we want to make this work, okay? We want this kind of animation. And we want to give the artist the tools to supply it. Again, we can render all this, that's no problem. We need to help the artist give us the data. There are several tools that's used, but one of the most common and one of the oldest is called the lattice, the deformation lattice. All a lattice is a 3D extension of NURBS or Beziers. And when I mean 3D, I mean there is three, not 2D like a surface or 1D like a curve, 3D. Okay? So what we will do is we will just put a cube of control points around the original object. Okay? And we will have all of the control points. So we will have, you know, multiple control points all the way along and across every surface. And then even in the middle, there will be control points in the center of the cube, which makes them really hard to draw. Okay? So we'll give a lot of control points. And then we will take the basic Bezier curve technique, technically a tensor product Bezier. We aren't going to spend time talking about all those differences. We'll talk a little bit about them on Tuesday, but not much. And then when they come here, the artist just has to move a handful of points down to make the shape that they wanted to make, right? So they pull the points wherever they want to pull them. And then we take wherever each of these points was in the original lattice. We do the Bezier interpolation of the deformed lattice. We find where that point would be in the deformed lattice. Poof, we have the deformed object. Sometimes if we care, if the artist cares, we can say, you're welcome to have us add in volume preservation. And so we will measure the total volume of this object when we're done. And if it's too small, we'll just make it a little poofier, right? We can also do local volume preservation by pushing parts of the lattice around and so on. These are not hard things to add. Just add a little computation, a little scaling. And so this can give this sort of gummy, bouncy thing. Yes?
How do you go about making like weighted translations? So like if you take like a point in the corner or something, like have the vertices around it like move a fraction?
Right, you do it literally with Bezier. Okay, so in the 1D position, if I started with these points and I had this line, and then I were to move that control point over here, the whole line will sort of move, and this point on the curve will become that point on the curve, and the Bezier formula will just do that for me. It turns out that Bezier with a thing called a tensor product, which was described on homework 2, but I think nobody actually did, we can just extend this to as many dimensions as we want. Often what we'll do, the artist usually doesn't want all of these control points, so often we will hide some of them and compute them analytically from some average of the ones they do want. But this is the basic idea of a lot of lattice deformation type of animation. It's not a common feature of many things, but it's often something the artist will pull out at the last minute to tweak something, or occasionally they'll make entire television series based on this, right? That can work too. Questions about lattices? All right, now we're going to just briefly see how deep this pool goes. All right. So, on the description here, I have Wikipedia and a survey paper, and then I have And Beyond. Let's look at And Beyond briefly. And Beyond is a paper, okay? Paper called Mesh Puppetry. This came out, I think it was 2006, I could be wrong. What is mesh puppetry about? So this is a paper, and this is a paper from SIGGRAPH, so it has all kinds of pretty pictures. But what are they doing? They're starting with models with bones. Okay, they're doing skeletal animation. They're doing inverse kinematics on the bones. But they're then doing something special on top of that. They're saying, we're not going to have the artist use just multiplying matrices and adding and averaging. We're going to use our special knowledge with discrete geometry to find out where the mesh should go on top of it. And so they have all this stuff about how you do lots of math, right? And then they say, what happens, right, if you were to try to move the armadillo's right hand? Well, holding its other thing's fate, right? And you could say, this is what would happen if we solve our new special matrices this way without having to worry too much about the bones. Or if we say, no, hold the bone's length still, this is what you'll see instead. And so they have different ways of doing this, and then they keep going. And so they have lots of little pictures about what happens, and can you anchor people around, and so on, right? So they have lots of pictures, and there's movies that go along with it that we won't spend time taking, right? And then they have, okay, what if you wanted something to squish? Right, they have lots of pictures. Now, how do they do all this? By the magic of discrete geometry. We don't even pretend to begin to have time to go into discrete geometry properly. It would easily take an entire course to properly teach. That said, if you found analytic geometry not too bad, there is reasonable, it turns out there's a group of people that published a lot of cool papers like this. And then a lot of other people said, I can't get this to work. I don't know what this math is. It wasn't taught at my school. And so they actually published some papers in SIGGRAPH about how to learn discrete geometry. They're papers. They're not courses. They're painful to read. But they will teach it all to you if you want. And if you're really interested, I'm happy to sort of point you in those directions. And then they have all kinds of things like, what happens if we take a motion capture of a cat and try to apply it to a horse to show that they could do this, right? Huzzah. Okay? And that's how you always tell a SIGGRAPH paper is by what weird things did they do because they can and nobody else could, right? So, that's still just bones at its core, though. We can go beyond that. Let's try Lie group integrators. Anybody know what a Lie group is? We have one maybe. Yeah?
It's like an abelian group that follows a certain topology.
How many of you know what abelian and topology mean? Right. Great. Hooray! Lie groups. They're really cool. They're really cool. And so then they say, oh, let's see if we can make somebody ride a skateboard with relatively little inputs and so on. We'll use Lie group integrators. They talk about their integrators at length, have a few little pictures, some tables of symbols. If you have a table of symbols, it means you need to spend several hours with the paper. It usually also means it's worth it. And then they have graphs about what these mean in different cases. And if you read the whole paper, this is a really cool graph, but I don't have time to explain it to you. And you wouldn't really care. And then they go through all around and around and around, and what do they end up with? Hey, this is the weird thing. They end up with saying, I can tell you way more than bones. I can say, if a helicopter is to fly up and then across through an arch, what would be an energy reasonable way to do this if it was being controlled by a human inside of it with a yoke and paddles? Okay? So they actually have models using Lie group operators of the non-holonomic controls of the holonomic vehicle, and these all have technical definitions anyway, and they end up with the whole process of how things should move as if there was somebody driving it, even though there isn't. Okay? So we can do all of this. And how do we do it? With matrices. Everything's matrices, right? And they talk about how you can land things, and then they have these beautiful functions. Doesn't a function like that just sing to your soul, right? So we have that, but don't worry, we can do more than that. Let's try interactive elastic motion editing through space-time position constraints. Okay, all of these words mean things. We only have 5 minutes. Let's jump directly to pictures. Okay, here is their first picture. This is a really odd picture. When you see this, you know they're doing something that's very niche. Okay? What is this a picture of? They're trying to draw a picture of a rope bridge suspended between two cliff faces blowing in the wind. Which is something we need because movies, right? And they're saying something about its cool behavior. This would probably work better if we showed the video, but I didn't happen to download it, and I don't trust the internet here. And so then they have all of these things, right, about how would we be able to move squishy things? If we have this rubbery strand hanging off of a box and we want to have put in fewer or more pieces of detail, how could we make it move around for different kinds of constraints, trying to point out that this is something that actually happens. And then they have their cool animations. So they have a really bulky T-Rex skeleton because, I don't know, right? They're not artists, they're computer scientists. And so they had an animation where it was just walking. And then they said, we want to constrain it so that on this frame, its nose is touching the flower, and at this frame, its nose is touching the leaf. Find the most natural way of making that happen. Okay? This is the kind of thing this is doing. This is designed to say, I have a complete animation, I know nothing about it. I don't have any bones, I don't even know what the points are necessarily, I just know there are points. I don't know they're connected, I know nothing about them, except that they exist. And I want the artist to be able to give these high-level constraints. Its nose needs to touch the flower and it not to look weird. And that's the kind of things they're doing. Okay? And how are they doing it? By using cool math. And then they always have the, this is how we do it, and this is how other people do it. You always have to wonder, of course, how they got the other people to give them the pictures. Anyway, by trying to implement what the other people did, there's a whole lesson there, but this is not a grad class, so we won't go there. So there's a lot. This keeps going. Okay? There's a lot we can do in the process of trying to say, how do we give high-level controls to the animator and make something that looks reasonable? And typically it involves some level of understanding principles that people want conserved. They want things to bend uniformly. They want volume to be conserved. They don't want local deformations, only global deformations, right? They want narrow things to bend more than fat things. As you understand these general principles, you can start putting them in math, then turning the math into matrices, then solving the matrices over and over and over again until it gets close to what you want, and then giving it back to the artist. That principle is used in all of these techniques in some level to give the artist high-level controls over their animation. Anything you're really hoping we cover about animation that we haven't in our last 2 minutes? All right, we do have 2 minutes. Anything else you want to talk about? Yeah?
So it seems like a lot of this, like what they were doing on paper, is like, it just seems more like, I don't know, like simulation rather than like graphics. But is it just like graphics has considered all of this stuff now?
Yeah, but what are we simulating?
I guess like I was thinking it's like the position of a thing.
It's a position of a thing, but the only discipline that cares about that way of positioning things is graphics, right? Now, some of the inverse kinematics is actually studied quite a bit by robotics as well. And not uncommonly, graphics and robotics will have overlap. But the, I will just move the points to make the T-Rex's nose close to the flower, that's, it only works, like graphics is the domain that cares about that, right? And often, graphics will come in and it will say, somebody has a simulation, right? NASA knows how to simulate fluids over aircraft wings. That takes way too long and doesn't give us cool smoke trails. We're gonna see what they did, make it way faster, throw away some details, and make it cooler. And then we'll publish 50 papers. And we'll get to look at some of those 50 papers next week. Anything else in our last 30 seconds? Then I will see you all next week.